This is Audible.
HarperCollins presents A Long Way From Home by Kathy Glass. Read by Danica Fairman. Some stories have to wait to be told to gain the full picture and a better understanding of what happened. Anna's story is one of them. Part 1. Chapter 1. Lana. Although the children weren't babies, they appeared as helpless as the day they were born. Dressed only in nappies and ragged T-shirts, they were sitting or lying on the hard floors, or incarcerated in their cots. Their large eyes stared out blankly from emaciated faces. Some children were obviously disabled, others not, but all were badly undernourished and clearly developmentally delayed. The four rooms in the orphanage were hot and airless in the middle of summer. Flies circled around the broken ceiling fans and buzzed against the grids covering the windows. The only toys in any of the rooms were a few balls and a handful of building bricks, but no child played with them. And the silence was deafening and unnatural. Not one of the 30 or so infants cried, let alone spoke.
"This nice one,"
the care worker said in broken English, pausing at a cot containing a Down syndrome boy.
"He no give you trouble."
Elaine looked with renewed horror at the child rocking back and forth in the cot. A few wisps of fair hair covered his otherwise bald head. Open sores bled on his lips, and his face was so pale, it was doubtful he had ever felt the sunlight. He stared blankly into the distance. Elaine went to speak to him, but the care worker was already moving briskly to the next cot.
"Oh, this one,"
she said, tapping the metal bars of the cot and ignoring the fact that the child had been sick. Elaine fought back tears and looked to her husband to say something. Ian cleared his throat. The care worker, a large, brusque woman, seemed to be in charge. He didn't know what role she played and didn't want to upset her and risk their chance of a child.
"I'm sorry, we don't understand," he said, almost apologetically. "We were supposed to adopt a particular child. She's called Lana. We have a photograph of her here in our paperwork."
He went to unclip his briefcase. The care worker tapped his arm.
"No, no, Lana, that baby dead. You choose another baby. We have plenty."
Elaine's hand shot to her mouth.
"Dead? When?" she cried.
"We weren't told,"
Ian said. The care worker shrugged.
"You on plane?"
She died yesterday," Elaine asked, horrified.
"Maybe too late to tell you. You choose another baby. Plenty. Over here."
She led the way to another cot on the far side of the room.
"I want to go," Elaine said, taking Ian's arm. "We're leaving," he said to the care worker, who was waiting for them by the cot.
"You come here and see baby. Talk to it."
"No,"
Elaine cried.
"You no want baby?"
the care worker asked, a mixture of incredulity and impatience.
"Not like this," Ian said. "We came here for Lana, and you tell us she is dead. We are very upset."
"But you can choose another baby," she said,
as though they were in the wrong.
"No,"
Ian said firmly.
"We can't."
"Suit yourself,"
she said, clearly offended. Leaving the cot, she headed out of the room and towards the main door, a bunch of keys jangling at her hip. They followed.
"Lots of other parents come here and take our babies," she snapped.
"But not us,"
Ian said, annoyed. They waited while she unlocked the door. Ian hung back as Elaine stepped outside.
"Where's the doctor we've been dealing with?" he asked. "He was supposed to meet us here."
The care worker shrugged, either not understanding or refusing to answer.
"Dr. Chiobanu,"
Ian tried again.
"We spoke to him on the phone. Is he here?"
She shook her head.
You go now. I'm busy.
You tell him we came, he said. But she pushed at his arm, signalling for him to leave.
Ian and Elaine stepped outside, and the large metal door clanged shut behind them. A lone child screamed from inside. Elaine burst into tears and Ian put his arm around her.
I don't believe it, she sobbed. All this time, working towards the adoption, and that heartless woman tells us our baby is dead.
Although they'd never met little Lana, they'd felt a bond with her ever since they'd first received her details and photograph and considered her their daughter. This was supposed to have been the final stage in the adoption process that had begun nearly 2 years before, and it included a detailed social worker's report, references, medicals, and endless form-filling and expectation. Today, they should have met Lana for the first time, given the doctor their paperwork, and signed the forms for court. And while they waited for the court hearing, they would have visited Lana each day, loving her more and more. But that had all come to an abrupt and distressing end. Their baby had died. Ian gently guided his wife to the taxi they had waiting.
No baby?
The taxi driver asked, seeing their faces as they got into the back.
No, the baby died,
Ian replied, his voice shaking with emotion.
Oh, dear. It happens in this country, the driver said matter-of-factly. Many babies die here.
Ian nodded as Elaine wiped her eyes. They knew about the high infant mortality rate and the shocking conditions in some of the state-run orphanages that had contributed to their decision to adopt from this country. The driver glanced at them in the rearview mirror, started the car and pulled away.
I find you a healthy baby, he said. My cousin knows a lady who finds couples' babies. You no worry. She find one for you, and she very cheap.
That's kind of you, but no thank you, Ian said politely.
They'd been warned about these types of arrangements by other couples who had adopted from this country. There were many parents on the internet who were happy to share their experiences of international adoption to help others. While not always illegal, these private adoptions were fraught with problems, and money was demanded at each stage of the process. Yet, ironically, they'd followed the correct procedure, and look where it had got them.
You think about it, the driver said. I give you my telephone number when we stop.
Okay,
Ian said, without the strength to protest. The air conditioning in the reception of their 3-star hotel was a welcome relief after the heat outside. Ian and Elaine, desperate to be alone, caught the lift straight up to their room on the 3rd floor. The maid had been in and everything was clean and tidy in the bed made. It was such a stark contrast to the poverty outside that Elaine felt a familiar stab of guilt.
I don't think we're meant to have children, she said,
utterly defeated and sitting on the bed. Ian sighed and poured himself a glass of water from the flask that was refreshed daily.
Oh, I don't know, he said, as dejected as his wife. I expected to face some hurdles. Most of those we've been talking to who adopted from here did, but I never imagined this. To arrive and be told our child is dead, and then to be shown other children is heartless beyond belief.
Do you think what she's doing is legal? Elaine asked.
Who knows?
Oh, those poor children. She kept calling them babies, but they weren't. Some of them could have been 6 or 7, and most of them were disabled.
I suppose they are the ones no one wants to adopt,
Ian said sadly.
That care worker probably thought as Lana had died, we'd be desperate and grateful for any child.
Oh, I feel awful, but I really can't take on a disabled child. I told our social worker that right at the beginning.
Her voice caught.
I'm just not cut out for it.
Oh, I know, love. Me neither. We've been honest, and it wasn't fair to put us in that position.
He sat beside her on the bed and rested his head back, exhausted. They were having to deal with so many emotions, bereavement, shock, disappointment, and anger. At 42 and 38 respectively, this had been Ian and Elaine's last chance of a family. Elaine was infertile, IVF had failed, and they were considered too old to adopt a baby or very young child in their own country, the UK.
"I think we should just go home and forget about it," Elaine said, leaning her head on Ian's shoulder.
"Yes, I agree. But I'm going to speak to that Dr. Chiabanu first and tell him what I think. I don't want other couples going through what we have."
Half an hour later, when Ian felt up to it, he telephoned the orphanage, but was told by a care worker that Dr. Chiabanu wasn't there, so he left a message, which he wasn't sure the care worker understood, saying he'd call back later. After 2 hours, having heard nothing, Ian tried again and was told bluntly, "No doctor." But later that evening, with plans to change their flights the following day so they could return home as soon as possible, they received a phone call from Dr. Chiabanu. Ian steeled himself to say what he had to. He wasn't an aggressive man and avoided confrontation, but this needed to be said. Yet before he had a chance, Dr. Chiabanu said,
"Mr. Hudson, I'm sorry I wasn't there to meet you today, but my wife was taken to hospital."
"Thrown?" Ian said.
"Oh, I see. I hope it's nothing serious."
"It wasn't, thank you. A funny turn. She's home now. If you come to the orphanage tomorrow morning, you can meet your child."
"I don't understand," Ian said, shocked and confused. "We were told our baby was dead."
Elaine moved closer to the handset so she too could hear.
"Yes, Lana died," the doctor said evenly. "She was a sickly baby, so perhaps it was for the best that it happened here, rather than when you got home. I have another child. She is not sickly. You come here tomorrow, and I will arrange it."
Ian glanced at Elaine, not knowing what to say.
"You come tomorrow, and we go ahead," he repeated.
Taken completely unawares, Ian looked at Elaine for direction.
"You come here tomorrow at 11 and meet Anastasia. Now I have to go to my wife. Good night."
The line went dead. Chapter 2. Another Chance. Elaine and Ian were up most of that night discussing what had happened and what they should do. Prior to the doctor's phone call, they'd decided to bring forward their flight and return home childless. Yet now they were being offered the chance of another child, reigniting their hopes of having a family of their own. They were calmer now, but still had big concerns. This new child, Anastasia, had appeared very quickly, and with no background information, they were imagining all sorts of horrifying scenarios, including that she could have been abducted from her natural family, or the parents might have been put under pressure or even paid to give her up. Yet while the care worker they'd seen the day before probably didn't have the authority to find them another child, Dr. Chiabanu certainly did. He was a recognized professional in the adoption process in this country and had been recommended to them by other couples who had successfully adopted through him. Ian and Elaine talked themselves round in circles. They knew nothing about Anastasia, yet other couples had told them not to place too much emphasis on any details given before they'd seen the child, especially the child's birthday. Record-keeping was haphazard in this country, and if a woman gave birth in a remote village, it could take her weeks to register the child or get to the orphanage. Also, children going for adoption were portrayed in the best possible light, as developing countries such as this one relied on international adoption to take their orphaned and abandoned children. There was a lot to consider, but in the early hours they decided they would visit Dr. Chiabanu as he'd asked, and at least hear what he had to say about Anastasia, and take it from there.
"Perhaps it will be all right," Elaine said hopefully, as she finally drifted off to sleep.
"Whatever the outcome, I will always love you," Ian replied.
They were awake again at 5 a.m., showered and dressed and then went down for breakfast as soon as the restaurant opened at 6:30 a.m. On the way through the lobby, Ian stopped off at reception and booked a cab to pick them up at 10:30. The hotel had been recommended by Dr. Chiabanu, and the cab firm it used had experience of ferrying couples who were adopting. There were only four others in the restaurant having breakfast at that time, all businessmen in suits. The hotel had 30 rooms, and although it had been recommended by the doctor, as far as Elaine and Ian knew, they were the only would-be adopters staying at present. Some of the staff knew why they were there, and when they checked in, the receptionist had said she would arrange for a cot to be put in their room once the adoption had gone through. Unsurprisingly, Elaine had little appetite that morning, and only managed half a croissant and a cup of coffee. Ian, who showed his anxiety in different ways, had scrambled eggs on toast, but kept checking his phone and nervously straightening the napkin on his lap. Neither of them spoke. Not only were they exhausted from the emotion of the day before and too little sleep, but there was also nothing left to say. Either they still had a chance of adopting, or they'd return home as they'd arrived, a couple and not a family. During breakfast, an email came through to Ian's phone from one of the families they'd got to know online, who were also going through the process of adopting. They were eager to know how the meeting with Lana had gone. "Oh, I'll reply later," Ian said. "I can't face it now." After breakfast, they returned to their hotel room and tried to read the books they'd brought with them, but concentrating was near impossible. At 10:30, they were in the lobby waiting for the cab. They knew that little happened on time in this country. Sometimes it happened earlier, but more often late. The cab arrived at 10:40, not the same driver as the day before, but he knew why they were there. Elaine and Ian would have liked to be left to their thoughts during the journey, but the driver was chatty and direct. "You going to adopt?" he asked almost as soon as they got in.
"We're not sure," Ian replied.
"Why not?"
He glanced in the rearview mirror, puzzled. Elaine moved out of his line of vision so she didn't have to talk.
"Our baby was very sick and died," Ian said.
"Oh, I'm sorry. They find you another one?"
"Possibly."
"Boy or girl?"
"Girl," Ian said.
"I have children, a boy and a girl,"
the driver continued amicably as he drove.
"You meet your child today?"
"Maybe. We don't know yet," Ian replied.
Elaine gazed out of her side window. Although international adoption was well known in this country, it was still a source of interest to the locals, possibly because adoption wasn't part of their culture, hence all the state-run orphanages. They didn't adopt or foster and didn't really understand why anyone would.
"Many couples adopt from here," the driver said as he drove.
"Yes, I know," Ian agreed.
"This your first trip here?"
"Yes."
"Some couples come back 2-3 times to adopt. They must like our children a lot."
He grinned, and Ian met his gaze in the mirror with a polite smile.
"I take one couple 3 times to orphanages," he continued. "They from America. They adopt brothers and sisters, 6 in all. Very good people with lots of money."
Ian nodded.
"But we don't have lots of money. We saved up to make this trip."
"Oh, you good people too."
Yet while it was a strain having to make conversation, hearing about successful adoptions was heartening and proof that the system did work. Perhaps they had just been very unlucky and it would work out in the end. Perhaps. It was 11:15 when the cab pulled up in the lane outside the orphanage. Ian opened the door to get out.
"You wait here?" he asked the driver.
"Yes, no rush. Very important you spend time with your child."
There wasn't a meter running. Cab journeys were quoted in advance and included any waiting time. Elaine joined Ian in front of the high metal gate as the driver wound down his window and lit up a cigarette. A wire netting fence ran all around the perimeter of the orphanage, with a patch of land separating it from the building. This strip of land would have made a good outside children's play area had it not been so badly overgrown. Ian rattled the metal gate, the only way of attracting attention, as there wasn't a bell, and they waited. There'd been some rain in the night, and although the sun wasn't out, the humidity had risen. Elaine knocked away a fly. "They come soon," the driver said, and sounded his car horn. The door to the orphanage opened, and the care worker who'd dealt with them the day before came out, keys on the short chain at her waist. Elaine took a deep breath. She really didn't like the woman. Without acknowledging them, the care worker nodded to the driver and unlocked the gate.
"Thank you,"
Ian said, and they waited just inside while she locked the gate. They then followed her up the cracked cement path and in through the main door, which again she locked behind them.
"You wait here,"
she said brusquely, and disappeared down the corridor, her shoes clipping heavily on the hard tiled floor. A solitary child screamed in the distance, and Ian threw Elaine a reassuring smile. A few minutes later, Dr. Chiabanu appeared from the corridor. Although they'd never met him, they recognized him from his photograph online. In his mid-40s, of average height and build, he was wearing a dark suit with an open-neck shirt.
"Pleased to meet you,"
he said pleasantly, and, smiling, shook Elaine's hand, then Ian's.
"So you decided to give me another chance?"
Ian nodded awkwardly.
"No worries," he said, clapping Ian on the arm. "Come through to my office and we can talk."
His office overlooked the front of the orphanage, and through the window they could see their cab waiting in the lane. Dr. Chiabanu motioned for them to sit down. The room was small and cramped, with an old wooden table acting as a desk in the centre, and three chairs. Filing cabinets lined one wall and a fan stood on top of one beside an open bottle of water.
"Would you like a drink?"
the doctor offered, going to the bottle.
"No, thank you," they both said politely.
The bottle would very likely have been refilled with tap water, and while this was safe for locals to drink, they'd built up a resistance to its bacteria. It upset foreigners' stomachs. Placing his tumbler of water on the table, Dr. Chiabanu opened the top drawer of a filing cabinet and removed a folder.
"Your paperwork," he said,
returning to sit behind the table. He carefully opened the file before him. Elaine and Ian saw the top page was their initial application sent a year ago with passport-sized photographs of both of them.
"I have the rest of the paperwork you need in my briefcase," Ian said.
Dr. Chiabanu nodded and then, folding his arms, leaned forward in earnest.
"I am sorry you were disappointed yesterday. It is not good practice to have a couple arrive and find the child is no longer with us. It is a pity I could not be here to tell you personally. We are very short-staffed, and my two care workers have no time for breaking bad news gently."
He threw them a knowing smile, and Ian at least started to relax.
"As I said last night on the phone," the doctor continued, "Lana was a very sick baby. We did our best to save her, but it wasn't enough. She died peacefully in her sleep."
"What was the matter with her?"
Elaine asked, her voice slight.
"She wouldn't feed. Something wrong in her gut. But you needn't worry about that. We have to look to your future."
His gaze went from one to the other, gauging their reaction, and Ian nodded.
"I do not have a photograph yet of Anastasia. She has only just been given up for adoption, but she's healthy, and you can see her shortly. Her mother works abroad a lot, as many single women here have to. She's been leaving her with us since she was a baby. Now the mother has met a man who is going to marry her, so she will be leaving this country for good, for a better life."
"And she can't take her child with her?"
Elaine asked, horrified.
"No, it happens,"
Dr. Chiabanu said matter-of-factly. "The man may not even know she has a child. The mother believes her daughter will be better off here in the orphanage, as many parents in this country do." He sighed with exasperation, as though he didn't agree with this.
"I will explain to the mother that her daughter will have a better life being adopted by you rather than being left here."
So the child isn't free for adoption yet? Ian asked.
No, but she soon will be. I will speak to the mother today and get her to sign the forms, which I will take to the court personally.
Elaine and Ian knew that this wasn't so unusual. Part of the doctor's role was as an adoption facilitator, arranging and completing the formalities of adoption, as well as advising the adopters on procedure. The court will set a hearing date, and once the adoption has gone through, you will be issued with a new birth certificate, passport, and visa for the child. This was standard, and what would have happened with Lana's adoption had she lived.
How long will all this take if we decide to go ahead? Ian asked. With Lana, we were already a long way through the process. It would have been completed in 3 to 4 weeks. I have to work. We can't stay here indefinitely.
He hoped this didn't sound abrupt, but they had to be practical. The doctor gave a small shrug.
It shouldn't take too long. The legal system in this country can run slowly at times, but I will do everything in my power to speed things up.
Which didn't really tell them much.
How old is the child?
Elaine finally thought to ask, overwhelmed.
2 and a quarter,
the doctor said, glancing at a handwritten note tucked into their file.
Don't worry, I will make sure you have all the correct paperwork for her, including a medical.
She's a lot older than Lana, Elaine said.
Yes, but she is strong and healthy. Why don't you come and meet her? I am sure you will be happy.
Dr. Chiabanu immediately stood. He was used to having his word acted on, although he came across as caring. Ian and Elaine knew he only charged the minimum for his services, while some adoption facilitators were growing rich on the proceeds of international adoption, although no money reached the natural parents. It was illegal to give them anything, gifts or money. Elaine's heart missed a beat as she tucked her hand into Ian's, and they followed Dr. Chiabanu out of his office. Could it possibly be the moment they'd anticipated, worked towards and dreamed of for so long? Was it possible that after all the ups and downs and disappointments, they were going to meet a child who could be theirs? Ian's hand tightened in hers, and Elaine knew he was as nervous as she was. Chapter 3. Anxious.
Anastasia!
Dr. Chiabanu announced brightly, leading them to a cot in the second nursery room. Ian and Elaine met the child's inquisitive gaze with a mixture of awe and apprehension. Clearly not a baby, but an apparently healthy, bouncing child with personality and gusto. She was pulling on the bars of the cot as though demanding to be let out, and was so different to the 9-month-old baby they'd come to adopt, it took them a minute to adjust.
"Say hello to your new mummy and daddy," Dr. Chiabanu told her.
Anastasia babbled something in her own language.
"What did she say?" Elaine asked.
"It was just baby talk," the doctor replied. "Don't worry, she will quickly learn English and forget her life here."
"Hello,"
Elaine said tentatively, taking a step closer to the cot. Ian joined her. Anastasia looked at them, and they looked back. It was one of the most touching and surreal moments of their lives, as they were presented with this little stranger, who could shortly become their daughter.
"Why is she in a cot?" Elaine asked, without taking her gaze from Anastasia.
"To keep her safe," Dr. Chiabanu replied. "She is an active child, and would be gone from here given the chance."
"I don't blame her,"
Ian quipped, which helped ease the tension.
"I'll get her out and you can see how active she is," Dr. Chiabanu said.
Reaching over the cot side, he lifted out the child and set her on the floor. As soon as her bare feet touched the ground, she made a dash for the exit. Dr. Chiabanu called out something in her language and she stopped.
"You mustn't go out, it's not safe," he repeated to her in English.
She threw him an almost defiant look, but it was so quaint on the face of a cherubic 2-year-old that they all laughed. She was like a life-sized porcelain doll, Elaine thought, with her pale skin, clear blue eyes and fair hair, and wearing a little floral dress that was really far too small. But she did look healthy and robust, which was so important after what had happened to poor little Lana. Moving away from the door, Anastasia went to the closest cot, and peering through the bars, began talking to the child. He was very disabled, and lay motionless on his back, staring up at the ceiling, his misshapen limbs jutting out at odd angles.
"He's blind and deaf," Dr. Chiabanu said with a heartfelt sigh. "We do what we can, but..."
He left the sentence unfinished. It was as heartbreaking now for Elaine and Ian to see these children as it had been the day before. Although they hadn't been in this room, it was similar to the others, and the majority of the children in the cot seemed to have a severe physical and or mental disability. Elaine felt a pang of guilt for wanting a healthy child, but she knew her limitations. She couldn't cope with a badly disabled child. That took a very special person. For some moments they watched, spellbound, as Anastasia went from cot to cot, babbling to the infants in her own language and gently stroking their foreheads or holding their hands through the bars. Only a few responded by shifting their gaze to her. Most lay unresponsive and continued to stare blankly into space, as though they weren't aware she was even there.
"Can we take Anastasia outside and play ball for a while?" Elaine asked. The room was oppressive.
"Possibly tomorrow," Dr. Chiabanu said. "Today is just for you to meet her. I will speak to the mother, and then you can come back tomorrow and play with Anastasia."
Which they had to accept, and it seemed reasonable that the doctor would want to speak to the mother first to gain her consent to start the adoption process.
"Don't worry," he said, clapping Ian on the shoulder. "All will be well, I promise you."
They continued to watch Anastasia for a while longer as she went from cot to cot. How Elaine would have loved to pick her up and carry her home there and then, for the bonding process had begun, and she was already feeling protective towards her. Dr. Chiabanu made a move to go.
"So, you come back tomorrow?" he said.
"Yes, of course. What time?" Ian asked.
"I'll phone you in the morning in your hotel room to let you know."
He then called down the corridor for a care worker.
"Anastasia can stay out of her cot for now," he said to them. "She can help. She likes to help."
A different care worker appeared, but seemed no less harsh and abrasive in her manner than the other one. Dr. Chiabanu said something to her in their own language, and then called Anastasia, presumably to go with the care worker. Anastasia pretended not to hear and stayed by the cot.
"Now, please,"
the doctor said firmly, then repeated it in her own language. Anastasia dutifully turned and went over to the care worker. Elaine's heart clenched.
"Goodbye, love," she called after her. "See you tomorrow."
But Anastasia didn't reply, because of course she hadn't understood.
"You can teach her English when you visit,"
Dr. Chiabanu said, beginning towards the door.
"She will learn quickly. She's bright."
"Yes,"
Ian agreed, much happier now. Anastasia and the care worker were already out of sight as the doctor led the way to the main door.
"Do you want our paperwork now?"
Ian asked, having brought it with them in his briefcase.
"Tomorrow will do. We have plenty of time."
"But not too long, I hope,"
Ian said. The doctor smiled.
"Don't worry. You enjoy your stay here. See some of our beautiful country and let me take care of the rest."
He unlocked the door and they followed him down the path, where he let them out of the main gate, saying hello to their cab driver.
"So you'll phone us tomorrow morning to let us know what time we have to come?" Ian confirmed.
He would have liked a firm time, but had to accept that things ran differently in this country.
"Of course."
Dr. Chiabanu shook their hands and then returned inside, as Elaine and Ian climbed into the back of the cab.
"You look happier,"
the driver said.
"We are,"
Ian replied, taking Elaine's hand.
"You met your daughter?"
the driver asked, starting the engine.
"We did," they chimed. For although they hadn't actually had that conversation, they both instinctively knew that to adopt Anastasia was the right decision. They were beside themselves with joy.
The driver dropped them off at their hotel, and they went briefly to their room to freshen up, then had a light lunch in the hotel, including a glass of wine, to celebrate. While they ate, Ian messaged those who knew they were there and were waiting for news, telling them only that they had met their daughter and everything was fine. They would fill in the details about Lana's passing and Anastasia when they returned home. For now, this was the update their friends were waiting for, and his and Elaine's phones buzzed with messages of congratulations and good luck. They spent the afternoon walking around the local area, gazing into shop windows and down side alleys, and visiting the street market. They took lots of photographs. Although it was their first visit to the country, they'd read up about it and researched online, and wanted pictures of the area to show Anastasia when she was older. The social worker who'd assessed them for their suitability to adopt and compiled their home study report had emphasized how important it was for adopted children to know their roots. She said they had to be completely honest with the child from the start and recommended they compile a life story book and memory box, which they'd already begun, having taken photographs of the departure board at the airport and saved their boarding cards. They'd take photographs of Anastasia tomorrow and, if they were allowed, of the orphanage too. They'd keep the clothes she wore here and anything else significant or of sentimental value that would help give her a better understanding of her past. Elaine had also begun a diary of their journey through the adoption process, confiding their hopes and feelings from when they'd made that first phone call inquiring about adoption. Anastasia would know as much about her past as possible, just like the social worker had said, although possibly not about Lana. She must never feel second best. That evening, after dinner, they sat in their hotel room with a phrase book and tried to learn some of the language. But it was a very difficult language to learn, and they laughed at their feeble attempts to pronounce the words. Thankfully, Dr. Chiabanu spoke very good English, and it was important that Anastasia learnt English as soon as possible, so learning the local language for them was fun rather than necessary. They were in bed early and slept well. Nevertheless, they were downstairs at 7 a.m. having breakfast, excited at the prospect of spending time with Anastasia and not wanting to miss Dr. Chiabanu's phone call. As soon as they'd finished eating, they returned to their room. Although Dr. Chiabanu had both their mobile numbers, the network service in this country was notoriously haphazard and expensive, and they knew that most professions preferred to use landlines where possible. The morning slowly ticked by. The maid knocked on their door to make up their room, but they thanked her and told her not to bother today. The phone stayed perversely silent, and by noon, when Dr. Chiabanu still hadn't called, doubt and anxiety set in. "He definitely said he'd phone in the morning," Elaine said, "and the morning has gone now."
"Perhaps he got held up or called away," Ian offered.
"Or perhaps Anastasia's mother has refused to give consent and is taking Anastasia with her," Elaine said, voicing her worst fears. "If so, I can't go through this again, Ian. I can't. We forget about it and go home."
"We don't know that," Ian said, trying to be rational. "Let's assume for now that no news is good news." Elaine wasn't reassured.
"Dr. Chiabanu said we could visit this afternoon, but before long it's going to be too late. We can't just sit here waiting indefinitely."
"But we know from other couples that there is a lot of waiting and hanging around," Ian reminded her.
"But that was waiting for the court date," she said, irritable from worry.
"All right, calm down. We'll give him another hour, and then I'll phone at 1 o'clock.
The hour passed. The phone didn't ring, and their unease increased.
"Shall I phone, or will you?"
Elaine snapped at 1:05.
"I will,"
Ian said, but went to use the bathroom first. Elaine would have liked to give Dr. Chiabanu a piece of her mind for causing them all this extra stress. International adoption was emotional and fraught, even when it ran smoothly. But neither she nor Ian would criticize the doctor to his face, as they were relying on him to give them what they wanted more than anything in the world, a child of their own. He could keep them waiting for as long as he wanted, and they had to put up with it. Returning from the bathroom, Ian sat beside Elaine on the edge of the bed and pressed the speaker button on the phone so they could both hear the conversation. He keyed in the number to the orphanage, and to their surprise it was answered straight away by Dr. Chiabanu.
"It's Ian Hudson," he said,
a slight tremor in his voice.
"Hello, how are you?"
the doctor asked jovially, apparently oblivious to the worry he'd caused them. Elaine wrung her hands in her lap.
"We're okay," Ian said, "but we were expecting you to phone this morning about our visit this afternoon."
"Yes, come here tomorrow with your paperwork."
Not today," Ian asked.
"No, I have a visitor from the government coming this afternoon. Tomorrow is good."
Which again they had to accept.
"All right, so everything went well with the mother?"
"Yes."
"She has consented to the adoption?"
"Yes, of course. You and your wife will have to learn to trust me. I know what I am doing."
"Yes, I'm sure you do. I'm sorry," Ian said quickly. "We're just very anxious, having lost Lana. We couldn't bear another loss."
"And you won't have to. Come here tomorrow at 2:00, and you can spend time with your daughter."
"Thank you so much."
"You're welcome."
Chapter 4. Anastasia. With their confidence in Dr. Chiabanu restored, and looking forward to seeing Anastasia again, Elaine and Ian passed the following morning with a visit to the local supermarket. It wasn't a large shop, but it was crammed full of every type of good imaginable, including groceries, pharmaceuticals, underwear and socks, toys, beer, hardware, and numerous miscellaneous items. There was also a box of Christmas decorations, even though it was only August. They bought bottled water and some bread and ham for their lunch, as it was too expensive to keep eating in the hotel, and there weren't any cheap restaurants or cafes close by. They also found a colouring book, crayons, and a doll for Anastasia. Lana would have been too young for these. They had packed nappies, baby food, and first-year toys for her, which were still in the suitcase. They'd also brought with them some clothes to fit Lana that would be far too small for Anastasia. They'd have to buy more here before the adoption, as they knew the children often arrived at court only with what they stood up in. They returned to their hotel room to eat their picnic-style lunch, and then with Elaine carrying the bag of toys for Anastasia and Ian his briefcase containing the paperwork for Dr. Chiabanu, they waited in the lobby for the cab. They'd booked it for 15 minutes earlier than it needed to be, to allow time for it being late, so in fact it arrived to collect them on time.
"I've cracked it,"
Ian joked to Elaine, and she laughed conspiratorially. How much happier they were now. It was the same driver they'd had on their first trip to the orphanage, and he greeted them like long-lost friends, shaking their hands warmly and asking how they were.
"Perhaps we're tipping him too much,"
Ian whispered to Elaine as they climbed into the cab. But it was rather nice, reassuring to see a familiar, friendly face in a country where they knew no one and didn't speak the language. He was eager to know what had happened since he'd last seen them, when they'd arrived at the orphanage to be told Lana was dead. Ian briefly explained about meeting the doctor and Anastasia the day before, and that the adoption was going ahead. The driver was very pleased for them, and didn't seem to mind that they weren't using the lady his cousins knew.
"So, I'll be seeing lots of you," he said, for he knew the procedure.
Couples usually visited the child most days while they waited for the adoption to go through. He parked outside the orphanage, and as Ian and Elaine got out, he wished them luck and confirmed he would be waiting for them when they came out. It didn't matter how long they were. Trying to summon a cab outside the towns and cities was highly unreliable, and most cab drivers were happy to wait for hours if necessary. It added a little to their income and saved the clients a lot of aggravation. Ian rattled the gate to alert the staff to their presence, and the driver gave a blast of the car horn. A few moments later, Dr. Chiabanu appeared.
"Good afternoon," he called brightly, coming down the path.
He unlocked the gate and warmly shook their hands and said hello to the driver.
"So, we are all good?"
he asked Ian and Elaine as they followed him inside.
"Yes, thank you," they replied.
"You slept well? And the hotel is comfortable?"
he asked, showing them into his office.
"Yes, it's fine, thank you,"
Ian said, although staying in the hotel was purely practical. They'd been warned that the cheaper guest houses were very basic and unclean, and the court wouldn't be happy knowing the child would be taken to one of them. There would be at least a week between the adoption order being granted and the adoption papers, her passport and visa being issued, during which time Anastasia would be with them. While many children lived in far worse conditions than those found in guest houses, the courts expected better from the adoptive parents. The orphanage was quiet as usual, and Ian and Elaine sat at the table in Dr. Chiabanu's office as he offered them a glass of water, which they politely refused. He sat opposite them, their folder and other paperwork on the table in front of him.
"So I have spoken to Anastasia's mother," he said, taking a sip of his water. "She has agreed to you seeing the child for an hour each day before the adoption, but she has requested you do not take her outside."
"Okay," Ian said. "Can I ask why?"
"It's normal. The mothers are concerned you may abduct or harm the child."
They nodded.
"She has also asked that she has new clothes. Again, this is usual. She is very poor, and what we have at the orphanage is basic. You have brought some with you?"
"Yes," Elaine said. It was on their instruction sheet. "But they were for Lana. They are far too small for Anastasia. We were looking at some children's clothes this morning at the local supermarket, but they didn't have much choice."
"No, I will give you the address of a proper children's shop in town. You can go there."
He scribbled the address on the notepad, tore it off and passed it to Elaine.
"It's about a 20-minute cab ride from your hotel. The driver will know where it is."
"Thank you," Elaine said, and tucked the paper carefully into her bag.
"The clothes you brought with you for the other child you can donate to the orphanage," Dr. Chiabanu said. "We rely on donations."
"Yes, of course," Ian said,
although he would have liked to have been asked rather than instructed. They both knew the doctor wasn't being rude. It was just the way so many people in this country talked. They issued instructions rather than requests, so it could sound very curt and abrupt.
"Give me your paperwork now, please," Dr. Chiabanu said. "You have brought the originals?"
"Yes,"
Ian said. Unclipping his briefcase, he handed the file to the doctor. In it was their home study report, compiled over 8 months by their social worker, certificate of eligibility to adopt, medical reports, references, bank and mortgage statements showing they could afford to look after a child, and police checks, all of which had been notarized and translated. Ian had another complete set in his briefcase in case any went missing. Photocopies of the documents had already been sent, but the court required originals. They waited patiently as Dr. Chiabanu turned the pages, checking everything was there.
"Good," he said, flicking through the last few. "It seems to be in order. Now you need to sign these forms so I can process them."
He opened the second file and placed various forms in front of them, which they both signed. They weren't translated, but Ian and Elaine knew what they were and had been expecting them.
"Your request to adopt Anastasia," Dr. Chiabanu confirmed. "And in this one, you appoint me to represent you and act on your behalf."
The last form was a donation to the orphanage, and an amount equivalent to £500 had been entered. Again, this was standard, and they'd been expecting it.
"Do you want the donation now?" Elaine asked.
The doctor nodded. She opened her handbag and took out an envelope containing the local currency and passed it to him.
"And the second payment for you arrived in your account?" Ian asked.
"I haven't checked, but I'm sure it has," the doctor said.
They'd had to send an initial payment for the doctor's services when they'd first instructed him, and then a second payment to cover the court fees before they arrived. but these fees were small compared to what they'd already spent at home on their home study, certificate of eligibility, notarization, medicals, etc. All in all, including accommodation and travel, they estimated they would spend in the region of £25,000 for the adoption. A lot of money to them, but obviously worth every penny.
"So, now you have time with Anastasia," Dr. Chiabanu said.
Standing, he tucked the envelope into his inside jacket pocket.
"I will bank this later and give you a receipt. Come this way. Anastasia is in the playroom."
Their hopes rose at the mention of a playroom, but fell again as soon as they entered the room. It was very small and mostly empty. The only furniture was a beanbag in one corner on which Anastasia sat waiting. Beside her were a few old and broken toys.
"Hello, love," Elaine said, going over and sitting beside her on the floor.
Anastasia was wearing the same dress as the day before.
"I'll leave you to it, then," Dr. Chiabanu said. "Let someone know when it is time for you to go."
"Thank you," Ian said.
Dr. Chiabanu closed the door behind them.
"How are you, love?" Elaine asked gently.
Ian joined them on the floor, setting his briefcase to one side. Anastasia stared at them, and then tugged at the carrier bag looped over Elaine's arm.
"Oh, you'd like to see what I have in here, would you?"
Elaine asked, pleased.
"Of course. These are for you."
She took out the doll and placed it in Anastasia's lap.
"Doll," Elaine said. "For Anastasia." "Can you say doll?" "Doll."
She knew that children learned language through imitation and repetition, but Anastasia was more interested in what else was in the carrier bag.
"Crayons,"
Elaine said, handing her the packet of wax crayons, "and a colouring book." She set it on the floor and stuffed the empty carrier bag into her pocket. Although Anastasia was only 2 1/4, Elaine and Ian had friends with children of a similar age who managed to hold a crayon and make large swirls of different colours. But Anastasia had never seen a crayon close up before, let alone used one. She spent some moments examining the packet and then selecting the red crayon, put it in her mouth.
"No, love," Elaine said, stopping her. "It's not to eat. It's a crayon. We use it for colouring in. I'll show you."
She took another crayon from the packet and passed one to Ian, and together they began colouring in the first picture in the book, which was of a teddy bear wearing a spotted hat and scarf. Anastasia watched intently for a while, then lost interest and, dropping the crayon, picked up the doll.
"Doll," Elaine said. "You like the doll?"
Anastasia stared at them, as though wondering who on earth these strangers were and why they were here.
"It must be so difficult for her," Ian said. "I hope Dr. Chiabanu has tried to explain to her what is happening."
"I would think he has," Elaine said, concentrating on Anastasia.
Suddenly Anastasia jumped up and, still holding the doll, ran to the window. Ian and Elaine followed her. The only redemptive feature of the room was a large window that looked out to the woods at the back of the orphanage. There were bars at the window and the glass was dirty, but it gave more natural light than the small grids in the nursery rooms, and the view was encouraging. Anastasia reached one hand through the bars and banged on the glass with her little fist, then looked up at them imploringly. She didn't need language to make herself understood.
"We can't go outside," Elaine said gently. "One day we will, after we've been to court."
Anastasia banged on the glass again and then held up the doll so she could have a glimpse of the outside.
It was touching and upsetting.
Anastasia hadn't spent all her life in the orphanage as many of the other children had. Some of it had been with her mother, so she knew a very different world lay out there.
"Come on, let's do some colouring," Elaine encouraged,
but Anastasia remained glued to the window.
"I don't think she's been in this room before," Ian said. "She's fascinated by the window."
"No," Elaine agreed. "I get the feeling she spends most of her time in that cot,
or helping in those so-called nurseries. Elaine's eyes filled. Although they'd been aware of the conditions at these orphanages, it still hurt and angered them to see it for themselves.
"But we mustn't say anything," Ian reminded her. "They don't like criticism,"
which was one of the reasons change in social care had been slow. Elaine bent down to Anastasia's height.
"We'll take you out as soon as we can, love. We're going to visit lots and lots of places when we go home. Parks, the seaside, the zoo, activity centres, and when you're older, museums and castles. But for now, we have to stay here. Let's play with the doll."
Elaine gently drew Anastasia from the window into the beanbag, where she sat beside her. It was a very basic, cheap-looking doll, but it was all the store had. Its dress was held on by Velcro, and Elaine now showed Anastasia how to dress and undress the doll. Anastasia liked the tearing noise the Velcro made, and spent some time sticking and unsticking it. Then she spotted Ian's briefcase and made a grab for that.
"Do you want to see inside?" he asked, smiling.
Anastasia tugged at the flap.
"Okay, I'll show you, but you can't have what's in it. They are very important papers about you."
Ian unfastened the clip and allowed Anastasia to peer in, but he needn't have worried about her wanting the papers and files. They were of no interest to a 2-year-old, regardless of how important they might be. Anastasia was up again and at the window.
"Come on and we'll do some crayoning," Elaine said, going over.
Anastasia tapped on the glass and looked at her imploringly again.
"We can't go out," Elaine said, shaking her head to signal no. "Let's play with the doll again."
But even as she said it, it was clear that all the child's hopes lay in being allowed to go out.
"What about these toys?"
Elaine said, going over to the broken toy cars and 4 plastic building pots that were already in the room. Anastasia glanced over to where Elaine pointed, and then returned her attention to the window.
"Oh, I don't know what else to do," Elaine said to Ian. "We'll have to buy some more interesting toys when we go shopping."
Then she had a thought. Opening her handbag, she took out her mobile phone and went into the photo gallery.
"Look, Anastasia, pictures."
The child's interest was piqued. She turned from the window to look, then allowed Elaine to lead her to the beanbag, where she sat between them, and they spent a pleasant 10 minutes going through the photographs.
"Well done," Ian said to Elaine. "When she's finished with yours, we can look at the photos on my phone."
So the hour passed with photographs, some colouring, sticking and unsticking the Velcro on the doll's dress, and visits to the window. While Ian and Elaine had thought an hour was a very short time to spend with their future daughter when it had first been mentioned, now it seemed appropriate. They were emotionally exhausted, and had also used up their resources so that Anastasia had grown bored with what they had to offer. As well as gazing out of the window, she kept looking towards the door, perhaps wondering when it would be opened. When the hour was up and they told her it was time for them to go, and went to find someone to tell them they were leaving, she didn't resist. Far from it. She seemed pleased to see the care worker again, and ran to her side. But of course, what is familiar feels safe to a young child. Elaine and Ian said goodbye to Anastasia, and the care worker issued an instruction to Anastasia. Without looking back, she ran off into one of the rooms, and the care worker saw them out. As they collapsed into the back of the cab, the driver said,
"First few visits always difficult. You and child strangers. It will get better. I bring a lot of couples here, and they look like you to begin with. Shell-shocked."
Ian and Elaine laughed, relieved.
"That's the word, shell-shocked," Ian said. "You speak a lot of sense." "You tell my wife that," the driver replied with a cheeky grin.
Chapter 5. Shocked and Saddened. Back in their hotel room, Ian and Elaine went over the time they'd spent with Anastasia, holding a post-mortem on the things they felt they'd got right and those they hadn't.
"It will get easier each time we see her," Ian said.
It wasn't just the driver who'd said this, but other families who'd adopted. They'd warned them not to expect too much during the first week of introductions and to just go with what the child felt comfortable with. This had also been covered during the 3-day preparation course they'd had to attend in the UK as part of their adoption assessment. Ian booked cabs for the following day, one for 9:30.